wanna be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. Hey, can you hear the sound of hysteria? Let's stop blaming on America. Welcome to a new kind of tension. All across the alien nation, where everything is meant to be okay. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Pavlina Chernova, who is Professor of Economics at Franklin and Marshall College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as the Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she has been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. And she is the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pavlina Chernova.
Good to be with you.
And given that I'd like to talk with you about the state of economic literacy in the United States following the debt ceiling debacle and the S&P debt rating agency's repudiation of the deal that has set off financial tremors around the globe, with the stock market closing down 630 points today, I wonder if any lessons have been learned from this brazen act of stupidity that has the nation's self-inflicted financial wound getting worse, as those responsible blame everyone but themselves.
Yeah, I think that there are plenty of examples of stupidity and self-inflicted pain, for the last few weeks, from starting the debate on the debt ceiling to this downgrade. There's really just a whole lot of flawed economic ideas that are circulating out there that are driving the political discourse and this really misguided debt rating. The credit rating agencies are supposed to rate on ability to pay, not on willingness to pay. And there's no question in the market's minds and no question in economists' minds that the U.S. government is able to meet its obligations, because all of its obligations are in dollars, and there's just no technical or good economic reasons why the U.S. government cannot meet its obligations in dollars when it has sovereign control over its currency. So what seems to have happened is the S&P has now decided that, you know, the political gridlock may prevent the government from paying, but the political gridlock was resolved. They passed the deal, the debt deal. They raised the ceiling. So it is absolutely unclear what the S&P is trying to do. The markets are not buying it. They are, in fact, moving into Treasury securities. And so it seems to be, you know, perhaps politically motivated.
So does that mean then that the markets are not, as the mainstream press is reporting, and as the Republicans, who, after all, were the ones that manufactured this crisis and essentially held the nation hostage until they got their way, the notion that it's all about the deficit and the need to deal with the debt, and the quote, of course, the mantra that you hear is get our financial house in order. But it looks as if the market's actually responding to what they did, which is taking $2 trillion out of an already weak and sick economy. In other words, instead of priming the pump, they're turning off the tap.
That's right, exactly. So basically, the market understands this. The U.S. federal government can pay its obligations. It's not a matter of default. It's not a matter of the government going bankrupt. We just have to toss this idea out of the window and then focus on the impact of government policies. And the markets are looking at what the government is doing, and they're saying, look, the crisis continues. The American public will probably be held hostage for the next decade, given that we have sort of enshrined into law austerity policies and cuts for the next 10 years. Of course, you know, it remains to be seen what deal will be cut out in October and November, but if we continue with this notion that somehow the U.S. government debt and deficit is public enemy number one, that has to be dealt with through cuts and austerity policies, I'm afraid that we are going to be in some trouble in the future. And so if there's one thing that I'd like to sort of, you know, impress upon the public with respect to the government deficit is this very basic, simple idea that there is always a counterpart to the deficit somewhere in the private sector in the form of a surplus. If you look at the data, it bears it out very clearly. A government deficit is always equal to a non-government surplus to the penny. And so then the question is, what will happen to the private sector balances, essentially, when we remove this source of stimulus, when we remove the source of cash flows and incomes that government deficit spending provides? And clearly, they will be reduced. And so there is always a counterpart to the reduction in the deficit. It means that the non-government sector will be accumulating fewer net financial assets.
I understand at this point, Pavlina, before this decision was taken the austerity decision was taken, my understanding is that $2 out of $10 in circulation come from the government, and that is a huge part of what keeps the economy going, particularly in this recession. And you would think that Economics 101 would make it real clear that what we need to do is restore demand and employment, and all of our problems go away. We wouldn't be having this discussion if we were back to, you know, demand a couple of years ago and employment a couple of years ago.
This is absolutely correct. I mean, it is Economics 101. We know that government spending is part of GDP, and in the absence of strong consumer demand and investment demand, government spending is our main source of demand, and that has been the case over the last 2 years. Now there is this, this idea that somehow if the government stops spending, the private sector will magically, boost its confidence and start hiring. And this is really problematic. The private sector hires for one reason only: when they see strong demand coming from somewhere, when there is profit expectations on the horizon, and when our main source of demand dissipates, I'm really not clear why the private sector will actually start hiring and improving the employment situation. So this is absolutely correct. So the focus of the discussion has to be on jobs, employment, on incomes. If you take care of the economy, the debt and the deficits take care of themselves. I think that this myth that we have to deal, put our house, fiscal house in order, is diverting attention from the real problems. I mean, just today, I think State of American Children report came out, and it was really quite distressing. There are 1 in 5 children in poverty, 1 in 6 people on food stamps. We have the highest child poverty rate of all developed nations by quite a large margin. And so we've got some very specific and real problems to address, and yet policy seems to be slashing the very programs that are assisting the poor, the low-income groups, the middle-income class, children, and on and on. So it's politics completely upside down.
Again, I'm speaking with Pavlina Chernova, who is an economics professor at Franklin and Marshall College and a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. Well, Pavlina, there was just a poll out a couple of days ago that made it clear that 82% of the American people agree with what you said before we talked about the children aspect, and you've prompted me to realize that we've got to do a program on this tomorrow, on this terrible statistics that you just read and this report that's just come out. But just back to the idea that the real economic discussion should be about jobs and not deficits. 82% of the American people agree with that. So can you explain to me and our audience what the president was thinking? Why did he do what he did? Because what he did is going to hurt him and the Democrats get reelected.
Well, I think that he's betting the opposite. I think that he is trying to play the middle, and he thinks that that will win him the election. He may be right. The problem is that the middle keeps shifting to the right, and he has not participated in any meaningful way in redefining what the middle means or what the center means. Just he keeps moving to the right and keeps really offering, you know, the kind of sacrifices that I wouldn't expect from a Democratic president. In the debates, he offered $650 billion cuts in Social Security. I mean, this is something to ponder for years to come. You know, luckily that, you know, Boehner walked out, and then what will happen to Social Security remains to be seen. Hopefully the Democrats will stand by this program. But I think that the electorate is smarter than this. They are very disillusioned with, there's a good chunk of the electorate that is disillusioned with Obama's policies, and they were hoping that he will be bolder and more progressive. And I don't see really a progressive agenda in Obama's policymaking. If anything, I see quite a conservative agenda. So at the end of the day, the impact of these austerities, I mean, that will not be felt right away. You know, the cuts are very small for next year. However, the stimulus that was passed in 2009 is already expiring. The funds have been almost completely disbursed. And so we're going to be in for some, you know, very serious times and, you know, sluggish, stagnant growth and really no improvements in the, you know, meaningful improvements in the jobs picture. I think people will have very little tolerance for this. But the other problem, I think, in the, you know, sort of in the conventional understanding of the government stimulus was that it didn't really work. And that's why, in part, a portion of the electorate has stood behind some of these austerity policies. And we just need a very good education on what the stimulus did and what it didn't do. I'm quite surprised that, you know, the Obama administration hasn't been out there and saying, look, you know, we have funded the following kinds of activities on the state level, public investments, infrastructure, education. These are the kinds of jobs that we have created. These are the number of jobs. I mean, this has to be the message of the Obama administration. Unfortunately, if you look at the stimulus numbers, you know, it shows that the stimulus worked, but it didn't create nearly enough. In the current employment situation, where we have 20 million people that are unemployed or underemployed, the stimulus created somewhere between 1.5 and 3.5 million jobs. I mean, that just can't do it. You know, it won't cut it. And so we just have to do more of that. And, you know, people can go on the government website and look at the specific projects that the government has funded from the overall stimulus package of $800 billion that they passed. You know, some of it went to tax cuts and some of it went to unemployment insurance and entitlements, but about 275 went to actual direct job creation. And you see a series of, you know, research projects, R&D, you know, medical research, police departments that received money, educational institutions, housing projects, on and on and on and on. These are very tangible things. The Obama administration has got to bring them out to the fore and say, look, this is how many jobs we created. We just have to do more of the same.
Well, the thing that worries me, Pavlina Chernova, is that in the absence of defending Social Security and the president apparently put it on the table in these negotiations, and everybody knows, or everybody should know, and of course we are dealing with economic illiteracy here, but the Social Security pays for itself. It's not a problem. Medicare is not a problem. Except the private part of medicine, the healthcare industry, it's the private sector, which is the right. Vast bulk of it, that's out of control. That's why he tried to come forth with this healthcare reform, albeit, you know, a racehorse designed, you know, by a committee ends up being a camel. But the long and the short of it is this: Romney he's found an opening here. He's saying that S&P's decision to downgrade the U.S. debt was due largely to promises the federal government has made to entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. A nation just can't pay this much back. This is absolute monstrous lying stupidity, but it's out there on the political stump. He's the Republican front runner. And unless Obama starts shooting this nonsense down, the public's going to buy it.
Exactly. Well, okay, actually, on the Social Security, I have my suspicions, because Social Security was declared broke the first year it was passed. It has been the history of the Social Security program that there was always some policymaker that wanted to destroy this vital safety net. But it is one of those safety nets that across the board, Republican or Democrat, people want to defend. They are not so ready and willing to sacrifice it. So I have my skepticism. I think that people will vote against anyone who wants to dismantle Social Security, Medicare, and I think the latest the recent election in the New York State, in a very Republican district where a Democrat won, is very telling. People want to preserve Social Security and Medicare. So I think, and I hope, I really hope that this is a big gamble on Romney. Yes, there are important issues to address with respect to Medicare and private costs, private drug costs, etc. Social Security is a sound program. And speaking of poverty, it is the primary reason why we have seen a precipitous decline in elderly poverty in the United States. This is the only group that is not seeing an uptick in their poverty rates. You know, all the other groups are seeing a rise in poverty in the latest recession, except for the elderly.
And you just pointed out that this new report on poverty in children, which is, alarming.
Exactly. And so there is, if you dismantle Social Security, if then you dismantle one of the most important income support programs for the retired. So I certainly hope that the voters will not let this happen. But anything is possible. In this environment, I've been surprised many times.
But the idea that this is the reason why the S&P downgraded the U.S. debt rating is because of Social Security costs. I mean, somebody should get out there and refute that nonsense. That's what I find. Obviously, the campaign is going to start much later. It's bad enough that they take 2 or 3 years of our time running for president. A year is enough, and presumably at some point or other, the president's going to start running. But in the meantime, the progressives are thinking about running a challenger in the primary, and people are talking about a third party and all this stuff. So I just don't understand the reason that we began this discussion is trying to find out who's the advocate for economic literacy out there. Who's the giving us these teachable moments that we need so that we don't allow these stupid decisions to be made that unnecessarily impoverish millions of Americans?
The argumentation that it is entitlements that are really the problem is really just an ideological stance, pure and simple. The financial markets have wanted to get their hands on Social Security for many, many decades. It represents a huge source of profit, but we know what happens when you privatize such safety nets. And so we just have to make sure that we preserve these programs. But with respect to the propagation of false ideas, I'm afraid that my own profession has played a significant role as well. Some of these ideas can be found in the textbooks, and my profession is really due for a renaissance. We have failed to predict, not all of us, but en masse, the economic profession failed to predict the most serious crisis in the post-war era. It has failed to deliver meaningful proposals for recovery. We have still this sort of trickle-down model of economic recovery that is failing again and again. And so I think that, we have to look very carefully at the economic textbooks and the models to start generating some more sensible ideas about what governments can and cannot do. Unless we have these good models, the public is going to be misled by policymakers and their interests, I'm afraid.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Pavlina Cheneva.
talking to you.
Good talking to you, too. I've just been speaking then with Pavlina Chernova, who is Professor of Economics at Franklin and Marshall College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she's been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, and she's the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by Scott Klinger, the author, co-author of Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, that back in April we spoke with him, and he predicted that this very disaster would come to pass.